I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and it's time for another All Things Political. As of this Thursday, the president will have been in office 6 months. The Washington Post ABC poll released over the weekend shows that he's losing support, but not a whole lot of support among Republicans. In case you haven't seen this, his overall approval rating has dropped to 36% from 42% in April. His disapproval rating has risen 5 points to 58%. But 82% of Republicans, according to this poll, approve of the job he is doing. 62% strongly approve. And many people in this poll are concerned about the Democrats, saying that the Democrats just don't have much of a coherent message other than to be against Donald Trump. We'll be talking about that. We have two great guests with us this hour. John McCormack is joining us the first half hour of the program. And John has been with us many times before. He's senior writer at the Weekly Standard. And he will be talking about a number of issues. He is concerned about this Russian narrative. He said it's a pretty fast transition from the collusion narrative as a smear and a hoax to what's the big deal with collusion. We'll talk about some conservatives who have been expressing concern about possible collusion here or cooperation. And we'll be looking, of course, at health care. What is the conservative position on health care now that John McCain, and we wish him well, has had significant surgery? He'll be out of the Senate for a while, so the vote on health care law, the repeal of Obamacare, and a new bill will be delayed for some period of time, which some are saying could keep this from becoming law at all, because there will be more opposition during the next couple weeks. What do you think? We will talk about that and many, many other issues. John McCormack with us the first half hour of the program. The second half hour, Ron Elving will join us, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. We'll be welcoming phone calls for the whole hour. We're not spending a whole lot of time on the Russia story the first hour because we're doing a full hour on it, hour two of our program today. It doesn't mean that we can't talk about it, though, with John and Ron. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. John is at the Weekly Standard, senior writer, and he hails from Baldwin, Wisconsin. Hello, John. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Great to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Do you have any updated information on Senator McCain's health?
I don't. The statement over the weekend was that he's recovering, and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, seemed to indicate that it would be at least a week until he was back in office. And whether he gets back sooner or later, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the health care bill, evidently there's going to be a wait now until he returns. Some have said that the opposition to this bill will only grow over that period of time and make it less likely to become law. Do you agree or not?
Well, you know, the opposition is pretty strong, you know, depending on what poll you look at. The support for it is anywhere in the teens or maybe even the 20s. And the opposition seems to be at least a majority, if not a strong majority. So, you know, that's tough numbers. I'm not sure there's ever been a case where those polling numbers have been that bad and a piece of major legislation has passed. I guess what Republicans think right now is they're, you know, sort of, you know, they're darned if they do and they're darned if they don't, you know, pass anything. If the system just continues to get worse and worse without them passing something, they'll take the blame for that. And if they pass an unpopular bill, they'll take the blame for that. So I think the idea here is, if what matters the most is that they can, well, what I think matters the most is that they pass something that actually works. I think that some of them think they just need to pass something so they can say that they passed something. But I think the most important thing is how people are in the real world actually affected by this. A year from now, in 2018, 2020, that's what people's votes are going to be based on, not, you know, the TV ads and the debates that we're having today.
Do you think they're going to have to get much more support from the American public in order for this to not be a liability for the midterms?
You would. You'd have to. I mean, and I think and I'm not saying this is what's going to happen, but one example would be, you know, in Wisconsin, when Act 10 passed, it was deeply unpopular. I mean, not quite as unpopular as this health care bill, but I remember polls, you know, something like, you know, maybe 60-40 or 55-45. You know, it was a strong double-digit opposition. The opposition was stronger than the support for it. By the time the elections actually happened, the laws had taken effect, and in most school districts, it worked out pretty well. The sky didn't fall, as many had said. said, and so it worked out. So that's why, you know, I emphasize that these Republicans today in Congress, they can't just say, well, we passed something to repeal and replace Obamacare if it doesn't actually lower premiums and help people out and keep and while also providing a way to provide coverage for people with pre-existing conditions.
What is the conservative position, John, on health care?
You know, it's really interesting how it's evolved. You know, Ted Cruz, of all people, who was, you know, Mr. No a couple of years ago, in my view, has actually come up with a fairly reasonable compromise. It's not perfect, and it probably needs a little bit of work on it, but the idea behind it is that any insurer that offers a plan that adheres to all the Obamacare regulations, you know, about essential health benefits and not charging more for pre-existing conditions and all that stuff, as long as they provide one plan like that, they can go and sell cheaper plans that don't exactly come with all the bells and whistles, you know, more catastrophic plans for cheaper that would bring things down and make health insurance a lot more reasonable. I think that's fine. And the reason that would people who are in those Obamacare-compliant plans, it would still work is because the subsidies, they're tied to income. So for people who make less than 3.5 times the federal poverty line, that's about $85,000 for a family of four, they'd be getting sort of an open-ended commitment from the government to fund these and make sure that they're within an affordable level. That obviously creates some problem for, you know, families that are still middle class above that $85,000 for a family of four level, where if they have pre-existing conditions, the cost of their plans could really go up. There is a pool of money behind all this, too, that can kind of help people out with that. But the idea behind it, which you wouldn't have heard conservatives say a few years ago from people like Ron Johnson and Ted Cruz, is that, listen, if we're going to cover people with pre-existing conditions, the taxpayer should pay for that. It shouldn't be this tiny slice of the population, the 7% of the population, whether it's a farmer or a small-town lawyer, who is on the individual market, you know, just because what we basically did, and I guess we all agree that pre-existing conditions should be covered, but we said we basically had this hidden tax for people just because they're on the individual market, just because they don't have employer insurance, they're paying, you know, 2, 3, 4 times, you know, the health insurance. Ron Johnson talked about a woman in Spooner, Wisconsin. She's 60 years old, had health care premiums of $270 a month. They've now gone up to, and she's basically healthy, 60-year-old. They've now gone up to 800 or so, and she can't afford that. You know, a middle-class person in America doesn't have an extra $7,000-$8,000 lying around, so she is got her fingers crossed right now, hoping that she can not get, you know, disastrously sick until she gets Medicare. So, you know, I think something like that would work. Maybe they need more money for it, but I think the general principle that if we're going to cover pre-existing conditions, we shouldn't do that with a hidden tax on people in the individual market, middle-class families in the individual market. We should, as a taxpayer, just spread that out evenly through the tax code.
Moderate senators like Susan Collins, who's been very outspoken about this, is very concerned about the number of people who may be cut from Medicaid.
Yes, that's the other big question right now. So there are, you know, the conservatives, Ted Cruz is okay with it. Mike Lee is still uncertain. He's on the right, whether this Cruz amendment will really do what they say it's going to do. On the other side of the caucus are these moderate senators. Susan Collins is a definite no. The other ones you have to watch for are Dean Heller of Nevada, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Rob Portman from Ohio. People like that who really are concerned about this Medicaid reform. What they've done is, you know, they're sort of paring back the expansion of Medicaid that took place in Obamacare, and they're also, in the future, far off, they're going to set a cap on the amount of Medicaid spending per person, and that cap would be tied to the rate of inflation. And Medicaid is generally, spending has increased much more greatly than inflation. So there's some debate about, you know, what exactly is the right amount. Back in 1970, Medicaid spending was something like 1.4% of the federal budget. It's now coming up on 10% of the federal budget. So there is a debate about, you know, what can be done, how that can be, whether it can be block granted back to the states, and what exactly the right funding formula is. But it is a problem with a lot of it is a program with a lot of problems. That's not even really serving the poor as well as it should be. Many doctors will no longer even take Medicaid patients because of reimbursement rates.
Do you know what Senator McCain's position is on this? Was he in favor of the current bill?
It's unclear. You know, he had some negative comments about it. He really didn't like the process, the idea that this is just rushed and brought to the floor. And, you know, they're not going through the committee process where this can really be thoroughly debated. They're sort of, you know, making their, you know, they released it a few weeks ago, and they made some tweaks and some amendments where they kept some of the taxes on high earners in order to, you know, have more money for Medicaid and for people at the lower end of the income scale. But McCain really didn't like the process by it, and had a few substantive concerns about as it related to Medicaid in Arizona. I would suspect that he's not going to be the deciding vote to cancel it. If McCain is against it, that means that there are 10 or 15 other Republicans who have decided against it. Right now, we've only got two, Rand Paul, the Libertarian from Kentucky, and Lisa Murkowski, and Susan Collins from Maine, who said they're no. With 52 Republicans in the caucus, that means they've got just enough votes if everybody else goes along with it. But if one more person says no, it will not pass.
I've read that this could be a pivotal vote as well. The Republican governor of Nevada has very deep concerns about Medicaid, and his concerns may also be the concerns, because he's the governor and he's been outspoken about this, to the Republican senator from the state of Nevada, another possible, and Senator Johnson from Wisconsin, for different reasons.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. I mean, so Dean Heller from Nevada, he is really one to watch, because he's probably the most vulnerable Republican senator up for re-election in 2018. Hillary Clinton won Nevada. Donald Trump is not popular there. Brian Sandoval, the governor, the Republican governor, is very popular. And so, you know, the top political journalists in Nevada, he said there's just zero chance that Dean Heller will vote for this thing without the support of the governor, Brian Sandoval. You know, whether or not there's enough money in there to tweak the Medicaid formula without losing any conservatives, I'm not sure about that. But that's really something to watch. And Ron Johnson, you know, very interestingly today, in the last couple of days, he said that he is concerned about voting for the bill because there have been reports in the Washington Post that Mitch McConnell has tried to get these moderate senators to vote for the bill by arguing that, hey, these, you know, the cuts are actually really far off, you know, 6, 7, 8 years down the road. You know, these are never going to take effect. A future Congress will undo them. I mean, it's important to note that they would be scheduled to take effect, and it would take an affirmative vote by a future Congress and a future president to reverse them.
Why is it, John, that on an issue that is of so much importance to the American people, there wouldn't be public hearings on this issue?
Yeah, you know, I don't think that's really defensible. We had an editorial by the editors, which I contributed to a couple weeks ago, saying, you know, the Republicans shouldn't do what Democrats did, and this is arguably worse. You know, Democrats did hold hearings, and it is true that they unveiled the final product, a week before Christmas, and debated it over the weekend, and had a vote on that. And we Republicans and conservatives criticize Democrats very strongly for that process. And I think Republicans are doing the exact same, if not worse, in terms of, you know, vetting this. You know, the best case defense of this is that it's really not passing a whole new entitlement. If anything, it's an amendment to Obamacare. You know, this is not repeal and replace, really, from my perspective. It keeps basically, you know, much of the structure of Obamacare in place while offering some, you know, the positive improvements, in my view, is that right now it would let people buy their, on the individual market, you can buy your health insurance with pre-tax dollars under this plan. Right now you can't do that. That's a big, you know, gaping hole. If you got an employer plan, that's all paid for with pre-tax dollars, so I don't see why not. And again, I think the general idea behind this Cruz Amendment, while, you know, the particulars might need to be worked out, is a good idea, that we should be the taxpayers. We should all be paying for these pre-existing condition subsidies rather than, you know, pushing that off onto people in the individual market, middle-class families. But, you know, that's where things stand right now.
The Washington Post ABC poll approval rating 36%, down from 42% in April, which is a fairly significant decline. Disapproval 58%. And yet among Republicans, the president is still doing fine. 82% of Republicans approve of the job he is doing. But overall, that number must be concerning to some Republicans.
Oh, it's got to be. I mean, that there is a very strong correlation between a president's job approval rating and congressional midterm elections. So I think, I mean, if President Trump is at 36% on Election Day in November 2018, I can't imagine that Republicans keep the House of Representatives, maybe not even the Senate. I mean, you got to recall that Democrats, you know, they lost Ted Kennedy's seat in Massachusetts, of all places, just a year after Obama won election back in 2008 with a very strong vote. votes. I mean, if Trump's way down at 36%, that's not going to happen. He criticizes Washington Post polls, saying that they're very inaccurate, when in fact they were almost spot on. Their final poll in 2016. It was Clinton 49, Trump 46, and the actual popular vote nationally was Clinton 48, Trump 46. So they, on the dot, got Trump's approval rating. And obviously you can have a bad poll here or there, but polling generally indicates that the president, especially since the firing of James Comey, his approval rating really has taken a dive.
I know this Russian story has been of concern to you. We're spending a full hour on it, but I'd like your response. You did a tweet recently. It's a pretty fast transition from the collusion narrative is a smear and a hoax to what's the big deal with collusion. Donald Trump, the president, tweeted, most politicians would have gone to a meeting like the one Don Jr. attended in order to get info on an opponent. That's politics. Would they have?
Well, I don't know if they would have or they wouldn't have. I know that it would have been wrong. Here's a simple test. What would you have thought if if Chelsea Clinton went into a meeting with people who said that they had Chinese spies who had obtained Trump's tax information, maybe not his tax returns themselves, but a lot of the interesting information that we would find from tax returns? You know, both would have been obtained illegally. The difference would have been that, you know, there was no subpoena for Trump's tax returns. It was just, you know, it's a common practice to release them. But still, you know, people could pretty clearly see from the, you know, if their eyesight is clouded by partisanship, I think they can see that if the shoe were on the other foot, they would find that outrageous to be working with a foreign adversary, very likely foreign spies, to obtain information illegally.
Mm-hmm. And how much is eyesight clouded by partisanship these days?
I think a fair amount. You know, it depends on who you talk to or what you read, but I think that, you know, it's a really strong impulse, and I think that, you know, if the shoe were on the other foot, I do think that, you know, I'm sure there'd be plenty of Democrats who would be defending a potential Hillary Clinton, you know, scandal like this. People do tend to circle the wagons. You know, the interesting thing you said about that Washington Post poll is that still 82% of Republicans are supporting Trump. I think what's happening is you're getting a smaller and smaller pool of Republicans that, you know, people who are really fed up with Trump, they're beginning to identify as independents in these polls.
And a large number of people are saying the Democrats really need some kind of plan here, something to stand for. All they seem to stand for is opposition to the president.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting debate. I think that's a common refrain. We got to stand for something. We can't just be against something.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, back in 2010, it worked out pretty well for Republicans to just be against President Obama. That didn't work out so well in 2012 when they actually had to run against him and had to present an alternative. So, you know, I don't know. Eventually, you probably do need to have some sort of positive agenda that, you know, resonates with middle America. But for now, I think they could probably just coast on, you know, opposition to Trump, maybe handing them the House of Representatives back in 2018.
Really? So you think that could happen?
Yeah, I think that could happen easily. Yeah, I mean, in 2010, what was the unified Republican message for their positive agenda? There really wasn't much of one. It was more of, we're going to be a check on President Obama, and that was more of an ideological or a policy check. So I think it really will depend on Republicans to sort of be a check on Trump's excesses with these investigations. If they have a chance of holding on to the House, they'll need to prove that they're not just in the tank for the president.
John McCormick is our first guest for All Things Political today. We have two, actually. We're welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. If you were asked to be one of the participants in that ABC Washington Post poll, what would you say about the job the president is doing? What are your thoughts about health care? Should there be public hearings? Do you think that the current bill, because of the surgery, serious surgery for Senator John McCain, will keep the bill from passing because more and more people will be coming out in opposition to this bill? We have yet to talk about, this news broke today, the Department of Homeland Security announcing a one-time increase of 15,000 additional visas for low-wage seasonal workers for the remainder of the fiscal year, which seems to be a change from Hire America rhetoric from the administration. There was heavy lobbying from fisheries, hospitality, and other industries that use temporary foreign workers. What do you make of that? What do you make of the continuing Russia story, which we will discuss at length, hour two of our program, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. John McCormack from Weekly Standard with us for a few more minutes, and then Ron Elving will join us from NPR. I'm interested in this story. I don't know where this came from. Maybe it was just it was obviously very successful, but extremely heavy lobbying from hospitality, other industries. 15,000, one-time increase of 15,000 additional visas for low-wage seasonal workers for the remainder of this fiscal year. What do you make of that, John?
You know, to tell you the truth, I don't really have a strong opinion one way or the other, necessarily. I think it is kind of dependent on, you know, the given industry and the labor market there. On one hand, you know, you'd think that, you know, a lot of seasonal work can probably be accomplished by, you know, in some cases by teenagers, people getting their first summer job. We've actually had a really troubling decline in the teenage workforce. Part of that is the rise of the minimum wage, where they're getting priced out of the labor market. And I think people really do learn a lot of valuable lessons in those summer jobs. So, you know, that's one concern. Obviously, when you're talking about seasonal work, you're not really talking about a permanent, good-paying job. But there are some people who could benefit from that. There was just a story I read today that, you know, in Maine, the hospitality industry is actually looking more towards American citizens to do this work, paying better wages, more flexible schedules that have sometimes appealed to even older Americans, retirees who are looking for a day or two of work a week. On the other hand, you know, it does depend on the industry, and, you know, So I think it really, you know, I don't have the technical expertise to really weigh in on, you know, the specific resorts and specific states and what's needed and what's not. But it is an interesting question.
Let's go to a couple phone calls for you, and then we'll go to another guest. Richard in Madison, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
The idea of John McCain being in surgery, and that, you know, I wish him well. John McCain is assured that his medical bills will be paid because he's a member of the Senate. Now, why is it that congressmen and senators have assured health insurance, but the rest of us have? We don't.
John.
Well, I mean, we're, you know, year seven into Obamacare. So we have had health reform, and if you're unhappy with us, it's an unhappiness with what was enacted 7 years ago. The members of Congress, in addition to a salary, as part of their job, they have a health insurance plan, as other people have employer-provided coverage. You know, I don't think what everyone's saying right now is they want to think of a way. They've got different ways to provide financial assistance to people, you know, on the individual market, especially those with pre-existing conditions. There are disagreements about how that should be done and how much money that we should be spent, but I don't think that there's anyone who wants to deny health care to anyone.
The single payer, somebody wrote this over the weekend, is poised to become the standard position for the Democratic base, maybe for the country eventually, as a result of all of this back and forth on health care. Really, for many years now, we haven't figured it out.
You know, you hear a lot of that, and I think there's a very reasonable case to be made that's where we're trending towards. You know, Donald Trump has praised single-payer health care. You know, his election has probably helped bring that thinking along in the Republican Party. On the other hand, you got to think about the fact that, again, what is the problem with health insurance? And it is generally, you know, if you look at the polls, people with employer-provided coverage, you know, 80-90% of people are actually happy with the insurance coverage and that they're getting right now. So a system that completely upends the entire system that we've got for insurance, you know, I could really see a real backlash to that. So I don't think people have really quite thought through, you know, that the problems with health insurance, they really do tend to be people who, you know, don't have health insurance through their employer. They're on the individual market, and, you know, whether they're, you know, whether they have health problems or not, you know, the premiums are just too expensive, the deductibles are way too expensive, and so it's really that sector of the country that where the attention should be focused. And I'm not sure that a plan that is really radical and you know, completely upends the system. You know, they just looked in California, looked into what it would cost, and, you know, single payer in California would be twice the state budget right now. Now, obviously, people wouldn't have health insurance premiums through their employers, or, you know, or their employers paying that, or on the individual markets. That's the trade-off there. But, you know, I wouldn't be so sure. Right now, that's kind of what people are thinking, is that that's where we're heading. But I could see something that's pretty radical, or a big-time reform in healthcare. It kind of seems that anybody who makes any move on this issue, you know, gets gored and at the ballot box.
John, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
John McCormack, senior writer at the Weekly Standard, and he is from Baldwin, Wisconsin. Ron Elving joining us now, senior editor and correspondent, Washington desk for NPR News. He has been with NPR since 1999, and at one point in his career, he worked for the Milwaukee Journal. So he will be with us now, and we'll be welcoming more phone calls for him on a number of issues. Ron Elving, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be with you this summer in particular.
Yeah, thank you. I'm retiring. I think Ron knows that. So, all right. This Thursday, 6 months since Donald Trump has been in office. Doesn't it seem, because of the rapidity of the stories, and I'm sure you must feel this as a prominent member of the national press covering this administration, it feels in some ways like it's been years, doesn't it?
It does seem longer than 6 months, and that may be because the Donald Trump phenomenon in American political life has really been going on for a couple of years. Started in the spring of 2015, he had, of course, been something of a main figure in the entertainment world and the real estate world in New York, but a fringe figure in American politics up until that time. Then when he declared himself for president, he quickly went to the head of the pack among Republican candidates, even in the summer of 2015 and into the fall, and dominated in many of the debates in that year. So in a sense, we've all been a little bit gobsmacked by the success of Donald Trump for about 2 years now, and particularly since he closed the gap and won in November and won his election in the Electoral College. And that had a tremendous amount of, shall we say, amazed reaction from people in Washington. And I would have to add, in both parties, there is a great deal of evidence that the Republican Party was counting on Hillary Clinton to win the presidency last November, and they have shown that in a number of their behaviors since then, not being entirely prepared to take over on some of the issues, including health care.
Can we talk about what's happened in the media and what's happened with the truth in this country? There were some interesting pieces in the New York Times yesterday. Frank Bruni's column was interesting, that Trump's fans don't blame him, and he still has a lot of support, according to that latest poll among Republicans. He has stirred partisanship and distrust of institutions in the conviction there is no such thing as objective truth. Is that a serious problem in this country right now?
I believe it is a serious problem. I wouldn't attribute it entirely to Donald Trump. I would say to some degree he is as much a symptom as he is a cause of that mental attitude on the part of American voters. He might not have been as successful as he was in the primaries over the last couple of years, let alone last November, if it were not already the attitude of a great number of Americans that everything about our politics is illegitimate on some level, that it's not on the level, and that they are getting a raw deal, and in many cases, they probably are, and they tend to attribute that to elites, probably far from where they live, and people they don't really know that much about, but people that they have gotten a major impression of through a variety of means, including the media.
Mm-hmm. And yet some really significant events have taken place. So I don't know. We're dealing with a country now that has been an enemy of ours for a long period of time. They've done very bad things. They tried to alter the course of our election. They're probably at it again. You have this meeting with Donald Trump Jr. with a Russian lawyer and a former cybersecurity expert and all these people involved in the Trump campaign. The president says, well, you know, this is politics. Anybody would have taken that kind of meeting. And yet you would think among most Americans, it would raise serious concerns.
It does, and polls show that something in the neighborhood of 3 out of 5, or even 2 out of 3, American voters are disturbed by this relationship that we don't know everything about yet, but seems to be coming clearer and clearer between at least some elements of the Trump campaign, or the Trump world, if you will, writ large, and some elements of the Russian power structure. Now, that would include Putin's government, Vladimir Putin's government, the, if you will, legitimate rulers of Russia. Perhaps we could argue about that to some degree, but certainly the people in charge, and also a lot of business people, oligarchs, as they're sometimes called, military figures, people who have a lot of power in Russia and who have been courted in the past by Donald Trump and who have in turn courted Donald Trump.
Let's talk about what could happen in 2020. This author of The Voting Wars from Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown writes about this possibility, which no longer seems far-fetched. By 2020, cyber attacks could try to alter or erase voter registration databases, bring down power grids, transportation infrastructure, or something else to interfere with actual voting on election day. Who is concerned about that? Who's going to stop that from happening?
I think an awful lot of people are concerned about it, and many people in government have been talking about it more in a sotto voce sort of way, under their breath almost, in private moments, for some years, not wanting to really bring it into the light so as not to alarm people or seem to be alarmist. That was the attitude of the Obama administration last year when they got strong indications of this interference that we now know is going on in 2016. They knew that there was a capability. They knew the Russians had done it in other countries, but we thought that we were maybe just a little too sophisticated, a little too smart, and a little too scary to the Russians for them to do it to us. It turned out that none of those things was the case, and the Russians were doing it to us, and they are capable of doing it again. That is the consensus of the American intelligence community. It's the consensus within the FBI, which was a little slower than some other agencies to go quite that far in their assessment. And they are very much involved in the counter-espionage, counter-terrorism business, and so is the Department of Homeland Security. And obviously the military. I think our utility companies have been talking about this for some while. Everyone has suddenly gotten some greater degree of conviction in their concern about this in just the last year or two, and that is one good thing out of everything that has happened.
Let's talk about health care, which we did a good portion of the first half hour of the show. Where do you think it stands right now with Senator McCain recuperating from what sounds like a serious operation to me, and there are reports that now with him recuperating, there won't be a vote on this until he returns, which could be some time. There's not a lot of wild enthusiasm for this bill among the American public. The CBO has yet to score it. I'm wondering what's going to happen with it. What do you think?
We're all in the same boat, Kathleen. We're all waiting to see what may happen next. And the first question, of course, is the condition of Senator McCain. Mm-hmm. Attended a dinner with him a couple, 3 weeks ago. He seemed to be maybe a little less than at his absolute great game that we remember from past years, certainly when he was the nominee of the Republican Party for president. And that's perhaps not all that surprising to some people who have been watching him that at the age of 80, a man who has survived cancer, not to mention 5 years in a North Vietnamese prisoner of war camp, you know, he is not necessarily at the top of his game. So will he be back next week? It's possible. Doctors say that it's possible that at the very best, this craniotomy that he has had will reveal just a really small problem that can be dealt with in a short time. He'll be back next week. He is said to be very frustrated and eager to come back. On the other hand, all these other factors have to be considered in terms of his health. He may not be back until later in July, possibly not until the August recess. And right now, the situation is Mitch McConnell does not have the votes that he needs to bring the bill to the floor. So popular or not, going to pass or not, the bill cannot even be brought to the floor until they get at least one more Republican to say that they'll vote for it. Mm-hmm. So the bill is in stasis for that reason. We also have about 9 or 10 members of the Republican caucus who haven't committed to voting for it or who have said straight out, no way I'm going to vote for it. So this is a bill in deep, deep trouble. The McConnell compromise pleased some of the conservatives, but it did nothing to appease those senators who were concerned about the effect on Medicaid in their states. There was nothing new on Medicaid. That issue is still where it was in the House bill and in the early Senate bill.
And when does the CBO score come out, Ron?
We expect to see the CBO score tomorrow. There had been some thought it might come out today. They did not say for certain it would come out tomorrow, but that is expected. It's hard to see how that score is going to be great news for Mitch McConnell and the Republicans. There may be some differences. There may be some changes. But the changes that have been made, again, do not correct the Medicaid cuts. So that's 14 or 15 million fewer people on coverage, just taking the bill the way it was the last time that CBO scored it. And then you also have the issue of how many more people might be deprived of insurance, or at least decent insurance, good insurance that meets the standards for basic health services, things like maternal care, maternity care. Mm-hmm. It's a question of whether or not that number is going to get even worse than it was under the original CBO scoring. So that's not likely to be a good news story for Mitch McConnell either.
Well, here's what I don't get. All these versions of the bill have been unpopular, very unpopular among the American public. I can't imagine there's going to be all of a sudden a huge increase in support for the latest version with that many people potentially losing health care coverage. So why do the Republicans proceed on this path? Because I can't help but think it's going to hurt them politically, isn't it?
It might well, and I believe many of the Republican senators fear the same thing, and that may even include Mitch McConnell. But his responsibility at this point as the head of the Senate Republican Party and the spear, if you will, the head of the spear, the tip of the head of the spear of the Republican effort to make good on its promise of the last 7 years to repeal Obamacare, root and branch, he has to follow through and at least get a bill to the floor if he possibly can and have amendments and have a debate and discuss it. And then if it goes down, if it can't get the votes that it needs to be passed, then he can at least say he tried. And if he can't do that, it is an enormous frustration, bruise on his career, defeat for him, not only personally, but as a leader of his party.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to that wall for a moment. The president's talked about building a wall now with solar panels on top, a transparent wall. Is that going anywhere? Are they building part of the wall now?
There may be some parts of the wall that are in design. Certainly the solar panel idea is being discussed. It's interesting, novel. There have been other large structures built with solar panels. Most of them do not stretch from the coast of California on the Pacific all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. But let us say that that is at least imaginative thinking. There is not a lot of enthusiasm for the wall as a project in Congress. Once again, Mitch McConnell, to bring up the name of the man who directs the traffic in the Senate as the Senate Majority Leader, has said that there would not be funding for the wall in the first months of this Congress and has shown minimal enthusiasm for the project in general. It is not a high priority for the Republicans in the House either. They have many other fish they would like to be frying. They would very much rather be talking about tax reform and a budget compromise and spending bills to keep the government open, because without them it's going to shut down at the end of September, and they also have to raise the debt ceiling, which is already, we've already exceeded it, and we're kind of keeping the Treasury operating with extraordinary means. We expect to see a higher debt ceiling passed, but it hasn't happened yet, and Congress really would much rather be talking about that than some of these more imaginative policy ideas.
Ron Elving, our guest, this part of All Things Political, senior editor and correspondent, Washington Desk for NPR News. We're welcoming phone calls for him, which we will start momentarily. The number, in case you forgot, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, love to read your messages there, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at KDunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. All right, Jim from Rice Lake, our first caller for you, Ron. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for having me again. I have a really important question, I think, for our guests. We can all disagree about policy issues, about the wall, about health care. We can all have healthy differences. But I think we all want integrity of our voting system. I propose to the guests, what if we had mandatory uniform paper ballots with electronic scan, which we have in many parts of Wisconsin, meaning you darken an arrow to show who you vote for, which is a paperback ballot, which is then electronically tabulated through electronic scan, which allows a certain paper backup, which if we're ever hacked, would ensure our integrity of our system. And secondly, by having uniform system, we would avoid disparate legal, disparate voting systems, and not ensure that the rich have more access to voting than the poor. I'd be interested in his response up
Thanks,
here.
Thanks, Jim.
Those sound like good ideas to me, Jim. I would also have to add, however, that every state has to decide how it's going to conduct its vote. That's in the Constitution. And it has been a frustration for many people who would like to see much more uniformity between the states and who would like to make the system simpler, particularly now in the cybernetic age, in the Internet age. Why couldn't we just have something that was state of the art, something that was as good as ordering from Amazon? Why couldn't we have something that was that reliable? And with all the backup that we might need. Those ideas with respect to a paper ballot, which gives people more of a feeling of security, that, it seems to me, would make a lot of sense. But the main problem for the political class in dealing with this is that you have to get all the states on the same page, and that has been historically difficult, partly because of suspicion between the states, partly because of just legitimate differences about what might be best. And then you have an overlay on that, which is quite alive right now, where we have a national commission that's supposed to be helping people get registered to vote, and the administration doesn't know whether or not it wants to fund that particular operation, but it has set up a completely different commission to study election integrity, and they have gone about trying to, well, compare all the records of all the states with each other to try to find people who are registered in multiple states or who might be committing voter fraud, and is very much dedicated to digging out the voter fraud the president himself has said does exist.
And that election integrity commission must be going nowhere because no states were giving much information. Is that going to proceed?
Well, there were 45 states that either said, no, absolutely not, we're not giving you all that data that you asked for, down to the last four digits of people's social security numbers and so forth. And 45 states said either we aren't going to give you any of that because we don't really recognize this commission as legitimate, or they just said we can't give you XYZ elements, including, actually, the state of Kansas, which is the home state of Kris Kobach, who is the vice chairman or co-chairman of this commission, who is the Secretary of State of Kansas, and who initiated this demand and sent it out more or less on his own authority to all 50 states and told them all to start sending this data in immediately. And there's just been enormous pushback and blowback from his sisters and brothers, who are other secretaries of state, again reminding him that the states really have a great deal of autonomy on this, and suddenly getting a demand from some election commission set up by Donald Trump and supposedly headed up by Vice President Pence and by Kris Kobach does not make them happy, and it does not make them feel they need to cooperate.
So it's going nowhere then?
Well, I wouldn't say nowhere. I think we're going to hear a great deal more from it and from Kris Kobach, and he will amend his request, and maybe it'll be delivered in a little bit different tone. Mm. And the states, some, will comply in varying degrees, but he's going to find it very difficult to compel total cooperation. And the more that it gets cast in the usual sort of partisan terms, probably the less effect it will ultimately have.
Doug in Watertown. Hi, Doug.
Hi. I've had a question as I listened to the debate, especially on health, that why haven't we been talking about the quality of care that we are getting? One-third, it's been estimated one-third of our total bill is due to paper shuffling. The free market model has not worked with health care. The survey after survey has said that the quality of our health care is not what it could be. And it seems like we're missing the point of, you know, what kind of health care do we want? And I would hope that it's not just a case, which I see right now, of health care for the rich and screw the poor people.
Ron.
The debate that we've been having in Washington for many, many years, really going back to Harry Truman in the 1940s, is mostly about health care insurance. Now, the government does directly provide health care to veterans and some others, but the biggest effect of public policy has been on the health care insurance market and also on hospital regulation, doctors' regulation, and that sort of thing. So the government, with those exceptions, does not actually provide the care. The government tries to set up a system to make sure that there is care for as many people as possible, and that it is supported for those who are least able to pay for it. So we have Medicaid, we have Medicare, we have other programs to help people get medical care. For example, states have the Children's Health Insurance Program, which is highly successful and which covers children while at least they're minors. And that, too, is a participation by government. So that in one way or another, the government is now involved with a little over half of all the dollars spent, and that's government at all levels, all the dollars spent on health care in America. None of that guarantees that the health care itself will be of the highest quality. And some people will argue that some of that government participation maybe stands in the way of the development of greater health care quality. And that's a separate debate. The big question in government today is who's going to pay for all this care, whether it gets better or it doesn't get better. We certainly know it's getting more expensive. And somebody is going to have to pay for it, or there are going to be those who can't get it. And we can guess that they will be the people with the fewest points of access, the people with the fewest means, and they will be the disadvantaged of our society. So unless you're willing, as some people perhaps are, to say healthcare is not a right, it's a privilege, like anything else. You want the best, you have to pay for it, and some are willing to say that. Unless we're willing to say that as a society, we are coming to a crossroads.
Mm. But it almost sounds like most people would agree with the idea that people should have health care, that the Affordable Care Act did move that in that direction, moved American sentiment, didn't it? Most of us think we should have health care.
Yes, and more people are willing to say, with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and some other Democratic politicians, and certainly this goes back again to the initiation of this debate after World War II by President Truman, health care is a right. Mm-hmm. Everyone who lives in this country, everyone who is a citizen of this country at least, should be able to access health care at least some level, maybe not the absolute finest doctor in the finest hospital in the biggest city, but that everyone should have at least some kind of a safety net of care. That is an idea that has risen and fallen in popularity. There have been times when it has seemed like a clear majority of people agreed with that. But the argument that we don't want government to make all of our decisions on health care, that we don't want socialized medicine, which is still a negative term to a lot of people, the idea that we in America are different from Europe and Canada and the other major industrial democracies that all have national health care, that idea remains strong in many parts of the country.
Hmm. Let's go to that Washington Post ABC poll over the weekend. The approval rating now for the president at 36%, still though 81 or 82% among Republicans. Is that significant? If it gets much lower than that, is he in danger?
There is a traditional notion that a president under 40% is a president with very little clout in Washington. And usually that applies to a president later in a presidency, after major national crises and controversies. The idea that a president would be at 36% in this latest ABC Washington Post poll after 6 months is unprecedented. Since we started doing that particular poll 70 years ago, no one has been that low. And usually presidents only get down into the 30s after some major reversal, the Iraq War, the controversies over Katrina back in the later years of George W. would have been the most recent example. So he is a highly controversial figure. He's been a divisive figure since the beginning. And yes, his numbers among Republicans are still very strong, although you have to wonder to many of them, what is the question they're hearing? Do you approve of how things are going under Donald Trump? Yes, many of them do. Many of them do strongly. Some others, I think, may be hearing the question as, well, would you have rather that Hillary Clinton won the election? And their answer to that is no. So they say they approve of President Trump.
One more phone call. It's from Janet in Elm Grove. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I just think this discussion about health insurance invites a bigger question, and that is really, what is health care today? When insurance was first being developed, I think back in the 1940s, all we could do was really treat disease. But now we have vast arsenals of preventive care and diagnostic care. I would like to see that made available to every citizen, because in the long run, treatment of stage one lung cancer is a lot cheaper than treating stage four lung cancer.
Thank you very much, Janet. Ron?
Amen to that, no question. But that preventive care is the greatest efficiency in all of healthcare. Healthy lifestyles, that is a great efficiency in terms of healthcare spending. For a society as a whole, experiencing the levels of diabetes type 2 that we have in this country and other kinds of behavior-related disease, this is the great challenge. Can we lower our health care costs by improving our own health? And I think that in the long run, that will be part of whatever solution emerges from all of this controversy.
Thanks, Janet, so much for your call. Ron, thank you. A real pleasure to interview you always. All the best to you.
Thanks, and all the best to you, Kathleen.
Thanks, Ron. Ron Elving, our guest for All Things Political. And we also thank John McCormick for being with us. John, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. Ron, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing this program and also for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. We're going to spend the whole hour, next hour, talking about collusion, possible collusion with the Russians, the meeting that Donald Trump Jr. had with the Russian lawyer and with now another Russian we learned over the weekend. Where is all of this going? What do we know? What do we have yet to know? Who's investigating? When are we going to know it all? That's coming up right after the news.